You're listening to a podcast from the RSA. You can find out more about RSA events and projects and how to get involved with the fellowship by visiting our website, thersa.org.
Good evening, everyone. I'm Matthew Taylor. I'm Chief Executive of the RSA. I'm delighted to welcome you all for this evening's very special event. We had at lunchtime in this room Matteo Ricard, who's a Buddhist monk and is supposed to be the happiest man in the world. So hopefully he's left some aura around to lift you up. So, before I hand over to Rachel, I just want to say a quick word about this event, which is part of an innovative climate events with a difference series that has been created by the research and events team here at the RSA. Spurred on by the publication of Jonathan Rosen's Seven Dimensions of Climate Change report, we've started these public conversations in a bid to shake up the dialogue that surrounds climate change on a day when the newspapers at least are reporting that temperatures this year may rise to an all-time high, and to give a new take through this series on one of our most pressing and intractable global dilemmas. Our most pressing and intractable global dilemma, surely. You can watch our Power to Create animation for more information on how the RSA is using individual and collective creative power as a vital tool for social change. So we're very grateful for the support of Sean Ferguson and the Climate Change Collaboration, and Jamie Clark and the Climate Outreach and Information Network, and we hope that after tonight's event, you'll join us for a drink to discuss some of the issues, maybe to organise as a consequence of being motivated and mobilised by what you've heard over the next hour. So let me now hand over to Rachel McCarthy, a senior climate scientist at the Met Office and the 2015 Poet Laureate's Choice, who obviously could not be a more perfect guide for this evening's events. So please give a big hand to Rachel McCarthy.
Well, good evening, everyone, and what an absolute pleasure it is to be here. When I was invited to chair this, what I hope will be quite a lively discussion later on, it got me thinking. So I work in the world of science. The language of science is the language of English, but it is also quite different. How we use terms like uncertainty or error are very different from what you would think they are, you know, in general. If I said to you, I am uncertain about something, you would think I am unsure. If I say to a scientific colleague, I am uncertain, they say, oh, within what bounds? There are two things that we have in common here tonight, I think. They are the challenge of climate change and the problems that are posed by climate variability and climate change and language. And tonight is a celebration of language. It's about the use of language and how we use that language to communicate better. So as a scientist within my realm, communication works very well. These terms are all understood. Uncertainty, error. In a wider world, when we've got such a big problem, perhaps they don't work so well. So tonight, I'd like us to, and my job as chair really, I think, is to make us think about language, how we use it, what it means. What are the pauses in language for? What is the differentiation between cold, clerical, scientific language and the language that we share as humans? Not even English, but the language that we share as humans. So I was presented with most of the pieces that you will see this evening, and you'll see me pop up and say things about them. I think tonight is about questioning. And it's definitely not about climate science scripture in any way. It's not about saying, we know the world is warming. We do. There is no, when you see words about debate, there is no debate. The world is warming. It's extremely likely over the past 50 years that humans have been the dominant cause of that warming. So tonight isn't a debate, it's a response. I guess that's also what this document that the RSA have produced is about. When I was looking at the poems and the multimedia material that has been submitted, at first when I was writing my notes, I thought, oh, I'll introduce everyone. You know, here's their awards, here's what they've won, here's X, Y, Z. For a start, I'd get bored of myself because basically the people that we have here tonight have won basically every award that's going. So I'd be repeating myself quite a lot. But also, none of this is about the individual. It's a collective issue. So therefore, I wanted to allow poets to, and artists and video makers to come up and do what they do. It's not about an individual, it is a collective. So I've went through all of the work that I saw, and I'm very privileged to have seen it. I feel like I'm in on some secret party that you guys don't know about, but are just about to find out. And as I was reading through, I was picking out phrases that, as a climatologist and as a poet, I thought were very, very valuable. So we're going to start this evening with Tom. And the line I took out of his poem was, "What we want to make of it." So I think that's the big question. The world, our society, etc. What we want to make of it. That is the question. And that's looking very much at humanity. You know, what does humanity do? And then I looked at Grace after Tom, who, a line from her poem says, "I stand and gaze into the trade winds." The trade winds are huge. If you don't know what the trade winds are, they drive a massive amount of weather around the planet. They're incredibly huge. It seems wrong to say structures because it's wind. But they're a big driving force. And then you have someone saying, "I stand." This is a person. And this huge force of weather, huge force of the world. And then if you take that idea of the individual, and Alice will follow Grace. I'm not using second names for a really good reason here. It's the same thing, that we're all the same. There's a line in Alice's poem that says, "In the same rush as them," where she talks about, you know, the world. It's not the world that is the human world. It is actually the entire ecosystem itself. It's not iPhones, it's not tablets, it's not Facebook. It's just the world. Please put your hands together and welcome Tom.
I first started writing seriously about climate change a couple of years ago as part of a project, which ended up actually having me walking groups of people down London's lost rivers. But it did start out with a kind of climate crisis agenda. And when I started researching climate crisis, I was a bit unsure of myself. And the emotions that came to me as I was investigating climate change and what it is, what can we do about it? The main emotions that came to me were confusion and shame. So this poem, which I'll start with, is about confusion and shame and climate. It's called Burial, or the Biodegradable Coffin Poem. You are nothing but a carbon Midas. Everything you touch turns to policy reports. The kid showed his electric pace, and I was a ball of nerves. A slow cow farts. The little girl mistakes a pylon for the Eiffel Tower. You may as well griddle the grid. My window is full of propellers. If all my statements include their own history, then how can we start? Let's demolish the old town, baby, for I'm already wasting on several fronts. After the poem, I'm spent like a cartridge, like money. Oh, honey, we've so far to go. So follow my flow till I'm sunk for a sink in a coffinless grave. And I'll move on to the poem that I've written for tonight, which I've printed out on a piece of scraggy A4 paper, very small in order to save on paper. And if you like, there's kind of two parts to the poem, a kind of before and after. It's very hard when you're asked to write about climate change not to write about icebergs or the apocalypse. So I decided not to worry too much and just go for it. Inside, it's all glitter and white rabbits, and everything crackles with the radio static of moving forces. Unseen flows so blue you'd think the sky had poured herself in. That surface glare and dazzle is what we want to make of it. For who would keep a rotting heart inside a cardboard box? What is falling apart, breaking away beneath a crust of pale gold? I'm sorry. We have already melted down the family relics for this quick fix, insisting that the ship will right that has fallen by the way. This is architecture, and it's on the move, son. You're going to have to live with that. After the great lithium dump, it was felt we might try to conserve. We hoarded palm oil and salt like the emperors of days gone by, till they too dwindled and were extinguished. For a time, peat was all the rage. We dredged the edgelands. We dug for it in gardens and derelict pools, in the relict Pingo beneath the Rockingham estate. Speculation flourished. They were speculating here, and they were speculating there. And whilst our bairns mudlarked for guano, there was a run on sugar water. When the peat dried up, we traded ice and nickel, rummaged the ruined citadels of Asia Minor. We stole the birdsong for klaxons. We led great terraformers across the steppes, broke the permafrost across the cities, with diggers tipped with carbide scavenged from the front. When stocks ran low, we entered the mangroves at dusk, trapped the spectacled caiman in his lair, and sucked his eyes for juju beans. We lay deflated in wrecked factories, for all had come to pass that had been foretold. Thanks.
I was asked to write a new poem, an unpublished poem, about climate change and the environment. And even though I feel I have other poems that are more relevant to this subject, I'll read this one that I wrote. And it's a kind of poem that came about because I was in Guyana recently, where I'm from. Guyana between Venezuela and Brazil. And I revisited one of my childhood haunts, which is the seawall and the Atlantic. The seawall keeps out the Atlantic. And so I thought I'd go up one midday for a visit. So the poem is about that. And it's called Except for the Lone Wave. Like a heiress drawn to her light-reflecting jewels, Atlantic draws me to the mirror of my oceanic small days. And the old seawall, so beloved by all. But Atlantic is far out, beach deserted in the midday sun, except for the lone wave of rubbish, old car tires, plastic bottles, styrofoam cups, rightly tossed back by an ocean's mood swings. Undisturbed, not even by a seabird, I stand and gaze into the trade winds, discovering that the sun is the only Eldorado, the only gold whose rays will grace and sear our skins. Like a tourist, I head back to the sanctuary of my hotel room to dwell on change and age and our brooding planet in the air-conditioned darkness. Thank you.
My poem is called Alongside Beans, and it's just a portrait of the strange non-human world that surrounds us. And it is a portrait drawn from weeding alongside my broad beans as they came out of the ground. Weeding alongside beans in the same rush as them. 6 a.m. scrabbling at the earth. Beans synchronized in rows. Soft, fanatical, irresponsible beans behind my back, breaking out of their mass grave. At first, just a rolled up flag. Then a bayonet, a pair of clapping hands. Then a shocked corpse hurrying up in prayer. And then another. And then, as if a lock had gone and the spring had broken loose, a hoverfly, not looking up, but lost in pause, landing its full stop on a bean leaf. And what a stomach bursting from its clips. What a nervous readiness attached to its lament and using the sound as a guardrail over the drop. And then another. And after a while, a flower, turning its head to one side like a bored emperor. And after a while, a flower, singing out a faint line of scent, and spinning around the same obsession with its task, and working with the same bewitched, slightly offhand look as the sea, covering first one place, and then another, and then another place, and then another, and after a while, another place, and then another. Thank you.
Covering one place and then another. The next thing that we'll see is, we won't see it, actually, we'll hear it. It's an audio piece by Sarah Warne, who's hiding over there, not on the front row with the rest of us. I just wanted to point her out. She has a brilliant, immersive piece that I'm not going to say a lot about, apart from the fact that the thing that it really said to me was that there was a real juxtaposition between calm and quiet and something quite jarring. I've known Ruth Padel for quite a long time. We figured out today it was probably about 8 years. Although neither of us feel that much older, hopefully. It was Ruth, actually, who put me in touch with the RSA about this event. Because Ruth, all the time that I've known her, has been incredibly passionate about the environment. And all her books attest to that. And if you haven't read them, you should. When I was presented with these poems, I was presented with this thing by Ruth, which is incredible. It's water, 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 water. 70% of the planet, and we don't really talk about it that much. And what it really means, what rainfall means, what flooding means, how that will change in the future. I can't do justice to that, so please put your hands together for Ruth.
Splashes of denial. 1. Water wars. Do you know where you are in the Milky Way? Look for the spun bud of the whirlpool, the last struggle of the water butterfly in toxic red mud, all that is left of our river when they have dug the heart out of the sacred mountain to extract aluminium for cooking foil, lightweight, incorruptible doors in the greenhouse, or missile submarines, and to connect the World Wide Web with your SIM card. 2. What lies beneath? Riffle through dying corals in your bed, all the things you don't want to know that you know. Serpents in your tide, witchcraft under the floor, and the luster of hidden fox foam sluicing from underworld right over the concrete piers, rotating cylinders and rough burled steel radial gates of Thames Barrier. 3. Water Museum. Look, a stockpile of old radiators, a heap of mad grins reminding you of winter mornings, pearls of your breath wetting your regulation scarf in the fog, or was it smog before any reference to warnings? As you walked to school from the station on ghostly red bricks, past ice-bladed reeds and a swan's nest with last year's swan's bride, a tissue ballerina haunting the mist. 4. Water is company. You close your eyes so you can't see the omens. You try praying for rain. You wait for an augury, sing to the brook while the self flies out and away like a bird from a withered branch, and the wind, with a hollow sound like a breaking pot, whips the lake to a dance of bubble froth soap suds blocking the drain. 5. Water connects. You hear the plink of stalactites, iTunes in sea melt, leaks from the unconscious like a gush from the pericardial sac. Now it's the water closet, the one truly fortified space where the skeptic can prepare his lecture undisturbed, because reality is not quite real enough till pushed through the mesh of words. 6. Water diviner. Down here, you're with the possible pre-verbal inner life, that holy well with skeletons at the bottom. You're not looking for fool's gold, that pretense at understanding dredging the seabed, covering mirrors so you can't see spirits of the dead. You want the real thing, don't you? You're that generation. Insight. Second sight. The view from on high, where you pause to observe the gulf stream,
the liquid green flame of Aurora Borealis and the 250-year million core of the Chakaltaya Glacier, once the highest ski resort on Earth. Now, a fossil feather memory, shingle and rock, where the through-flow ice gave up the ghost in the blink of an eye. 7. Water tells stories. I am your melted snowman, drops from a baby's bath, the first rain of the monsoon, a sacred draught from Mother Ganges, the ford of Brahmaputra where pilgrims keep an eye out for the man-eating leopard of Rudraprayag. I'm water from the moon, water pressure you don't want to mess with, moisture round the unbroken seal on Tutankhamun's tomb. 8. Mystery play, water carriers versus the dark arts. I am the voice of God in Noah and the Deluge, performed by the Guild of Water Leaders who draw from the River Dee. I watch the laughed-at few load bottled water and battery chickens into the ark, while strikers from Koch Industries and ExxonMobil play baseball on a quadrant of fair territory between foul lines in a flicker of echolalation throbbing quicker than the heart. They ring-fence the crucibulum, our little place of torment, a vessel for heating glass, metal, anything, us, to high temperature, and Skype lobbyists and politicians who orchestrate silence or cognitive dissonance. And the flood comes fleeting fast. 9. Waters of myth. I see you passing up the hazel wand, the phial of holy water lost along the way, and the psychic retreat of underground rivers, Mnemosune, Lethe, and Styx, that uber-black torrent of onyx which gods never cross. Those are the big three, sunshine, memory, forgetting, and death. Your Yorkstone flags crack in the kitchen, flop at the edge like a Dali clock running out of time to disclose an underspace you didn't know you had as the current whirls you down to the dragon foundations, bone of the planet, debris of alarm calls you don't want to face. 10. Waters of the mind. What is this drip, drip, drip down walls of the empty room? How quick, you say, there's nothing. But what you depend on is what you afraid of. What you're longing for, look, is the thing you pushing away and shut up in a painted flask. I am the tragic mask. I am how you defend yourself from knowledge that is catastrophe to have to know. How crystal translucence, the God-given flow shouting baptize and purify, is also the vector of cholera, polio, 1,000 industrial toxins that never degrade or die. Water reflects. Like lovers' vows written in aquamarine, the stories we tell about ourselves dissolve, break, and quiver. They may not seem truth, but all we have. I offer mine as if they were true, and trust you to deal with me truly too. We are in this together. I'm a door half open to you, my glass other, my mirror. 12. Water is boundary. Who'll remember the hour of your birth, when the north wind changed and the owl in the chimney swung back in its cowl? What flows from you to me floods back to make you afraid of everything you said? Where have your own words been? What is this owl gaze into the soul, the glug, glug, glug of between? as if you knew too much. And all that erudition has alchemized into the tarot pack of the Inquisition. And 13. Water riddles. Is it a whisper from the Hierophant, the Minotaur below your inner ear, or a ripple from the unconscious, the whole pack of major arcana you try not to hear? A voice from the deep, anyway. Maybe riddle 74 from the Exeter manuscripts of water words. A snarl from Grendel's mother, the shape-shifting monster interred with stars in the lake. 14. Slippery. I'm a word which means storm, but also men with a problem. I'm the mystery adjective, a voice from the past, the wham of a fountain released by one hoof thud from Pegasus. And now the diminuendo of a waterfall in thinning rainforest, the music of splash slowing to trickle, chords from a burning vat when you open up a hoard of body parts. 15. Water music. I am the surface tension you take for granted, the jazz musician alone at the end of the world, playing clarinet into an underwater mic. A cat's paw of black swirling silt, the last wave that breaks the levee, modal harmony in the improvisation of Jelly Roll Morton, and the Louisiana water moccasin, laughing at delta houses built on higher and higher stilts. 16. Water pressure. I am byproduct of the outer storm of gas, dust, and shock waves when a star is born. My courses speak to new understandings of the soul. My ruffled means threat when a young man whose territory and identity are shrinking lifts an AK-47 and gives his life to jihad. I am the inside appearing outside, the Anglo-Saxon for tempest, heaven, and imagination all at once. I'm the place where you're never in place. You have to dive in. 17. Princess at the well. I could be an Ottoman fountain between two gazelles, a white hand waving from the shelter of a lake, offering a choice, the sword or the tambourine, before it's too late. I am the cistern under the foundations of Istanbul, dedicated to Medusa, who will turn us to stone. I am nine columns, nine translucent midsummer muses, drawn from the marrow of nine glaciers in Iceland, melting at nine different speeds. I am the golden fleece, sunscatter on the Black Sea, where a princess falls in love with a sea captain who believes profit and market economy matter more than folk tales of 4 degrees warming. An adventurer for whom she betrays her father, her brother, and who she was meant to be. 18. Water plays mother. I am where you came from, the alternative to oxygen, the element where you began and could never return, despite the blandishments of the silky. I'm the womb where you don't belong. Face it, you were expelled. I'm the dream time all mermaids flitter back to at daybreak. Water hyacinths choking up good lilies, and a swallow hibernating in mud at the bottom of a river where everything that disappeared from your life has got stuck. I am the winter solstice furred up in frost, star of the different road back, the water you can't get rid of in your eye, your knee, on the brain. 19. Water is identity. I am easily lost, shifting away to unhallowed ground you don't think to protect. I am what you don't recognize by any other name. The scarlet fleck and the black and white eye of Shiva set fast in the now dry Himalaya. And a swamp cloud of mosquitoes swarming through the veil of health. I am being privatized. Price per gallon, I sell higher than oil. But I am the flow and the rise, the live breathing of the planet, all the questions about origin you have never let yourself ask. 20. Banquet at the water table. Who owns beneath? I am the just discovered reservoir, vast as the sum of all oceans, locked in the sapphire polymorphic of rhynwardite, between upper and lower layers of Earth's mantle, which Time magazine says will solve everything. But what happens to the heat and the pressure holding the planet together if you take me out? 21. Water changes everything about the way a planet behaves. Pour me in bottles, inhale the whiff of Charybdis, I'll go my own way, make a splash, separate into vapor. You can't hold me back. I invent the concept of wave. Water of life. I have no form without a container. I am the damned. The 1,000 tons of me it takes to make 1 ton of aluminium. I am blood in a fountain pen signing a contract to maximize productivity, throwing white light in the eyes of the world and bringing on, swifter and surer than thought, a final burning glass drought in the heart of India. 23. I'm the shimmer of oil from yet another spill in the Niger Basin. The journey this drop from your tap has taken to get here. I'm slurred semiquavers hurrying through the overture to the magic flute, the refracted cycle of evaporation, precipitation, and runoff. That's me trying to reach the sea, which you just don't want to think about. You do anything not to. One day, you must. 24. Water's last word. You will seek me in depths of the desert with rotary drills and artesian wells and give the aquifers no thanks. You will defend access to me with gyro stabilizers on the fully traversing turret of Sherman tanks from which a gunner can aim on the move. When I'm not to be had, you turn to alchemy and subterfuge. You will sacrifice anything, your health service, your child, your bill of rights. Then you curse the hurricanes and floods, 40 blue days and 40 black nights, the tide of dysentery, the exhalation of plague. Look for me in spray at the end of the hosepipe, end of the rainbow, end of the year when light fails in the Arctic Circle. I turn up in particles, the damp patch, the swan song, the bubble rosette of decay. You turn me on without thinking and can't turn me off. You'll see the ocean suck itself dry and return as a death wall blocking the vault of the sky. Shares in me are sold on the dark web. But I play my own rules. You might seek and not find, yet you need me like breath, like prayer or the deep space of God, like a halo of gold for the last blind wingbone of self that cannot bear to own and now repair its own fault. Thank you.
As I was listening to Ruth, and as I've read this poem also before, I went through and underlined things that meant quite a lot to me. All the things you don't want to know that you know. You close your eyes so you can't see the omens. Because reality is not quite real enough. Alarm calls you don't want to face. Thank you for the chime. It's good. It marks Salima's video. So we're going to play a video now. I only actually saw it a couple of hours before. You won't be seeing it. The thing that I took from it was, in the same way that I take elements of Ruth's poem, about the world being quite small. It is a small world, and this film, I think, shows that it is, the world is a condensing and a condensing and a condensing. And leaves the question, what is the outcome of that?
We have each become a small world, spinning from one collision to another. We scrub cities off our skins and watch its roads leave tracks in the bath. We are tower block light flickers come evening, crammed into shoeboxes, basements, living room come bedrooms, stretch out our feet to turn the TV on. Reach out for our phones, our faces made radiant by its birdsong. Mining happening somewhere, but we can't be sure. We are compassion in 140 characters. We are lying lonely next to each other between paper-thin walls. We know our neighbours' shouts and moans. She sounds like a redhead, I think. Rent rises, heat rises, sea rises. Put the kettle on, scald dinner in microwaves. Droughts happening somewhere, but we can't be sure. Tesco Metro fluorescence lives on. I wonder what this will all look like in 50 years' time. How will our cities exhale then? How will we wear this loss? How will we sleep when we cannot turn off our alarm clocks? We have each become a small world, spinning from one collision to another.
So we've spent, you know, over half a century on this road to self-sufficiency, to the point where now we don't know our neighbours, and we're living quite individualistic lifestyles, I think. And so for me, that's interesting in terms of how we relate to each other locally and globally, and how receptive we are to listen and empathise with other people, and particularly in the context of climate change, what does the flooding somewhere else in the world mean to you when your life is quite isolated and it bears no reflection on what's happening on the other side of the world? So I think we need to widen the climate change conversation. I think words like sustainability and climate change are off-putting. And if you ask somebody, do you think we should be sustainable? Most people would say yes, because that feels like the kinds of question that you should say yes to. But what it actually means, again, is a different thing. So instead, if we asked questions like, are you happy? Or despite all the stuff that we have access to, all this technology, all this resource, do we actually have everything that we need? And I think once we start having those kinds of conversations, it broadens what we associate with climate change and community. We need to get to a point where we're needing each other again, and we're becoming more of a community, because it's only that way that we will be able to build empathy both locally and globally.
Well, I think Salim has given us the starter for 10 for the drinks reception later, really, hasn't she? It's clearly quite a lot to talk about. This is the final quarter. Again, as I did in the first quarter, I just want to highlight a couple of phrases. Don't really want to say a lot about them. I think that's for you to think about. So John will be next up. There's a line in his poem, Inheritance. It's, if we, the children of the meek. And it's repeated. If we, the children of the meek. The question is, in this context, what does meek mean? Simon will follow him, and there's a line in his poem that says, "We know we've tried." And then we're going to end this evening with George, and I haven't seen George's poem yet. But that, to me, feels really appropriate, because there's a lot of things that, you know, that we think about, but we might not yet have seen. And how we think about things is not through the interpretation of me to you, it's to you as an individual, right? So I'm going to end there. If we, the children of the meek, John, with Simon, we know he's tried, and with George, to give the closing address. No pressure.
Well, this wasn't a poem written for this occasion, happily, because you can't write to order. I took the word creative response, meaning slanting response, because I love Emily Dickinson's comment, tell the truth and tell it slant. Or if you like cricket, reverse swing. There's that classic biblical quotation from the Sermon on the Mount, the meek shall inherit the earth. So that quotation got me going. So it's an unpublished poem, and I felt it had a slanting connection, I hope, to this. And it's called Inheritance. If we, the children of the meek, should inherit the earth, whose rainforest lungs breathe a tale of waste, an earth where the ailing sea shudders in its own slick. If we, the children of the meek, should inherit an earth where the grass goes nostalgic at the mention of green, and the sky looks out of its depth when reminded of blue. If we, the children of the meek, should inherit such an earth, then we ask of the future one question. Should we dance or break into the gnashing of teeth at the news of our inheritance.
Hello everyone, I'm Simon. I've got two poems for you. I've just spent 4 years researching a book about the sun, which is written from about the sun and from the point of view of the sun, a very strange character I've discovered over the years. So I took a very short poem from that book and I've extended it for this evening. That's the first poem. How's my coal getting on? I set as much aside for you as I could. Don't use it all up at once. It might come in handy one day. And how's my oil faring? It keeps best underground in the dark. Doesn't do so well in the light. Don't let it spoil. How's the wind blowing? I try to keep it moving. Keep it on the muscle, keep the pressure on, make it hustle. How's the hydro hanging? So much potential. You don't ought to dewater. Watch out for insects, bird life. You're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't. Any breaking news on wave power? I've hired an intern to handle the oceans. If we could make some ripples, get more converts, that would be swell. Geothermal sounds like a blast. I've got files and files on extremophiles, plucky geezers. There's life in the oven and life in the freezer. I'll keep the volcanoes ticking over for you. Nuclear's nothing new, but until some of you stop saying nuclear, I'm not sure it'll do. Hydrogen, now that's my bag. People say I'm full of it. But one day you'll get a grip. Stick with it. There's more than one way to fuse a cat. You've got to get off grid, kids. One day I'll blow the lid off. Your magnetosphere's too tempting for me. Like bubble wrap, I've got to pop. I assume you're using solar, right? This other stuff's for backup, in case there's a rainy day for me in space. Speaking of which, one day you'll sail away on a fair wind of photons. Remember me this way. The second poem is a love poem. It's kind of from one of Earth's poles to the other. And it's about that most complicated of issues, really, desire, what we want, what we actually want. It's called Polar Heart. Thank you for listening. Opposites attract. Perhaps. In fact. But the whole wide world bulges between us, overfed, underfed, and will not be denied. We know. We've tried. My love expands for 6 dark months while yours retracts to rally again as mine melts away for half a year. I know we have to stay so far apart. I know the climate needs our hopeless pas de deux, but sometimes at the solstice I yell, screw this, into the polar gale. And another ice shelf fails. Thank you.
I have to address a lot of different kinds of audiences. I'm a recording artist as well as a performance poet and a public speaker. I do a presentation across a range of issues. And because my audience tends to be quite diverse, I like to talk in a way or structure my messages in a way that take people from any walk of life. No assumptions about my audience ever. And that's how I've approached this poem. So I present to you A Climate of Change. A paradigm shift is a change in common sense. But how do you go about rearranging common sense? Especially with years of research and journalism making the conversation long and dense. Well, sense isn't something to try and enforce. It should be kind of endorsed by a reliable source. And in the case of climate change, a good place to start is science, of course. You remember science from school, an essential subject. Let's consider its relevance to the general public. Our scientists are in a position to advise us on some of our biggest decisions. And it's probably in our interest to listen, but also to invite others to witness the vision. The first way to do that is to be the vision. Through lifestyle choices, you can lead the mission. Bring the future to your present when it seems a bit distant. The cleanest existence is green and efficient. And you haven't fully played your part until your lifestyle reflects a change of heart. It's a continuous process. I'm still working on mine, but technology plays a major part, as does art. Now, as an artist, I play my part, but all I know is writing verse and harmonizing melody. Now, the point of working together on this is that one of you knows a thing or two about decarbonizing energy. So if you could consider that when making your plans, I'm happy to leave that one in your capable hands. This is the solution government can't offer. Ground level collaboration. Doesn't it sound better than having patience? Instead of sleepwalking into the governance trap, using imagination to take initiative as a nation, which involves looking at our economic ambitions and ensuring that as well as earning ourselves more and banking ourselves more, we're actually doing things that we're thanking ourselves for. You know, in the long run. Because a lucrative plan is a smart one, but a sustainable plan is a strong one. Thank you very much.
There's a couple of things that I've taken from tonight. Some that I expected, some that I didn't. Until I heard the pieces performed, and I hope that you actually feel the same way. In terms of language, we've had the funny and we've had the factual. In terms of science and how it's represented in poems, as a climatologist, there is nothing that heartens me more, actually, to see science well represented in poems. So often you see the terms misused, misappropriated, and tonight we've definitely not seen that. And a good place to start is science, of course. And it plays a major part, as does art, to quote George loosely. Thank you very much for coming here this evening, and I hope you've had a really enjoyable time and it's been a really enriching and questioning experience. I think that's also important. A round of applause for everyone.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, why not download our free app to access video and audio files on the go? Just visit our website, therSA.org, and follow the links to the RSA Vision mobile app.